Jason won that match against Shane, and Shane's the king, and he went up and stood in his chair. You don't stand in the king's chair.
Welcome back to another episode of the Q. That was a joke. That was a joke. I don't have coronavirus, I don't think.
Well,
but if I do, it would totally get transferred.
Episode. You know what an episode is like? You know, have you ever had an episode?
I think so. No.
Yeah. Okay. There you go.
You mean like the episode you had when I first called you and you started yelling at everything? Because I remember that episode. That
kind of, but you could call that an episode, couldn't you?
That was pretty close to an episode, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was an episode.
Demetrius, how many monsters you got down so far today?
Man, I'm only 16 ounces in, but we got some catching up to do.
Well, I guess we also have some podcasting we need to do too, huh?
That's right.
Well, I guess we can start it out with, we'll talk about this a little bit more later and kind of giving a small rundown of what we would have thought of the match, even though it's only postponed and not canceled, whatever that means. But the Roberto Gomez and Chip Compton match has been canceled. So that means that we're literally going to have nothing to talk about next week. So what does that mean for the podcast? Well, absolutely nothing. We're still going to do it. We will speculate on things. We will lie. We will cheat. We will do anything to get a podcast out. So you do not have to worry about, even if we don't have content, we will find a way to BS our way through something to try to make it entertaining to listen to. Because, there's already no pool content out there for the most part. So I think more than ever, this podcast is needed just to get people their figurative pool scratch if they don't have access to a table.
Well, this is no different than what happens at a normal pool hall. All the wolfing and matching up, and 95% of it never actually turns into a game, right? So I don't see how this should be any different.
Yeah, the success rate just went 5% down to 0%, though.
You know, it's 95% bar. You know, so that's what we'll do. We get to go old school.
Yeah, and Rob, you have nothing better to do with your life, anyways. You're in that demographic that you can't even think about going outside, or you'll get infected.
Yeah, well, hopefully the Social Security checks keep coming. And I heard some talk, maybe they're going to add a little. So us old folks who are more susceptible to actually expiring if we catch this thing, you know, because we got parts that are prime, you could say. They've been well used.
Yes, that's basically it. Yeah, Rob, good one. So the rest of the announcements we'll blow through really quickly. There's no new Patreon updates this week. We're gonna hold off 1 week, and we're gonna do the next drawing next week. There were no new Patreons this week, and that kind of makes sense. I mean, some people are really insecure about maybe their finances or trying to budget for what might be coming forward. So there will be no Patreon drawing this week. So the next one will be either next Monday or next Wednesday. And we will continue moving along with that. Other than that, there's really nothing else I have to get cleared up. So we can move right on to shout-outs. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I want to shout out to Gary Johnson. Plays out of Romines. My friend and I were talking the other day about attitudes at the table. And Gary said to my pool-playing friend, he said, listen, no matter what, no matter how you feel at that table, he said, you got to lie to yourself. If you feel like you might miss a shot or you don't like a situation that you're in, he says, don't show it. You eat that and you get rid of that. And no matter how you feel, you say to yourself, I'm going to go ahead and do this. And that was 50 years ago. And it's stuff that we talk about a little bit now. You're that mental preparation for a shot, getting rid of the other thoughts that go through your head. So my shout out is to you, Gary, for that comment to Mike 50 years ago.
Yeah, very good. Well, I've got a shout out, and it'll be to Hank Lennon. And so I'm a little unclear if it's Lenin. I think it was Lenin, but his real name is Harrison or Harry Lenin, but he goes by Hank. And I'll tell you, for those that don't know him, he is an 11-year-old out of the Minneapolis area, just a little bit down the southwest part of town. He's been playing in the youth league here for a couple of years, started playing pool, and has then gone on and joined an M8 kind of a pool league here. And he's been traveled around playing team tournaments, individual tournaments, and he's a great young player out of our Minneapolis area that has just been laying it down, man. He's been laying it down. He's been playing some great pool and really got the pool bug. It's fun to watch him run through tables and solve breakouts. And I mean, he's just, you know, learning to play the cue ball, learning to play the safeties, learning to play the breakouts, learning to play the patterns and watching his game come together. It's, you know, there's a lot of people that talk about all the future of pool and there's not enough young players. Well, let's talk about some of the young players coming into the game. And Hank, you're one of them. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. Oh, by the way, he's going to New Zealand with another young player from our area, Kennedy. They're going to be doing some international exhibitions. So we got some pretty cool stuff going on. So I will, Nate, maybe I can talk to you about sharing one of it. He just put a post on Facebook. Maybe we can link it up to Cue It Up podcast, and we can let people start following along with this young gentleman's career. I think he's going to have a pretty cool one.
Sounds like a plan. We'll have to talk after the podcast. So my shout out will be to Manny Cotto, and he just bought a Jacoby custom cue, and he has been going crazy ever since. Just wild, just waiting for this cue to show up like a kid on Christmas morning that lasts a week long. So it's really, really cool to see that kind of fire for the game. And he said he's been playing like 40 hours of pool a week since his lockdown started, and now he's laid off from his work, so he's going to be playing even more. It's great to see the fire for the game and the listeners of the podcast. So it's really cool to see. It's really cool to hear. And congrats on your new cue, and welcome to the Jacoby world. And I guess with that, we can start up on the podcast. So the obvious match that we are going to talk about, I can take a victory lap for getting the closest, so everybody congratulate me and tell me how great I am. Joshua Filler and James Aronish finishes up 100-72. So a couple takeaway from the match. James Aronish actually won day one. I believe it was 33-27, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was the end of day one. Filler wins day two, and if I'm not mistaken, that was 66-53.
Yep, 53.
Because it was a 13 game cushion, and then obviously it finishes up with 100-72. So I guess real quick takeaways. Anybody got something?
Boy, I love that was quite a match, and yeah, Nate, you called a big margin, and you know, you had the courage to call that margin, and then I guess I kind of went along with the ride, but you definitely planted the flag in the ground and said that was what's going to happen. And it you know, I'll tell you one thing is that even when Aranis got ahead 33-27 on day one, I really felt that Filler was going to do exactly what he did. And I know that's trust me, I was having moments of like, hey, you know, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, you know, Aranis plays practically as good as anyone in the world, and so, you know, why would maybe I felt a little bit like, was I being silly to think it was going to go that way? But I'm like, no, because here's what I thought about was that the thing about having Filler be on top of the world and having done what he's already done is that he knows he can do it. And Aranis, you know, he's sitting in his chair where he's still got to prove it. And so I actually talked to you about this briefly the other day. I was like, you know, suppose Filler's playing, he's got Aranis, how many shots in a race to 100 come up where you have a kind of a test of nerve and you've got to kind of dig deep and come with something that's like not normal, not easy, not automatic? You know, there might be 500, there might be a couple thousand, I don't know, but there's a lot of shots that come up where it's like you have to look yourself in the mirror and say, do I have what it takes to beat this best player in the world? And every time that Filler does that, he knows that he has what it takes because he's already done it. He's already proven to himself he can do it. So now he's like, this is where I win. But for James, every single time he does one of those, comes with one of those shots or has to hit a great shot or has to, you know, make a tough play, he's got to look himself in the mirror and look at his heart and say, do I have what it takes to beat Filler? And even if the answer to that is yes, most of the time, some of the time it's got to make an impact where it's like, I don't know. And if he waffles even just a little bit, you know, he's already got to play his best just to give himself an outside chance. And if he waffles even on, you know, 3 out of 100 of those testers because of that, he just can't afford to give Josh any kind of spot when it comes to confidence, belief, that kind of thing. And so it just seems really hard to look Filler in the eye for 3 days and respond to what he does on the table again and again and again with total conviction and confidence, which is something that Filler absolutely has, is total conviction and confidence. And so that's where it's like, you know, on paper they play so close, and even on day one he showed that, yes, he could play on any one day. He could definitely get there with anyone in the world, you know, around a skin. But to have to just stare at him for, you know, 30 hours and not play a 30-hour game of chicken in terms of belief and courage, Filler doesn't turn the steering wheel away. He's coming at you. And so that's a pretty tough game of chicken to play. So that's what I thought was really difficult for Aradas. And to be fair, you know, he never really fell apart. He delivered his game, and it may not have had a huge deal to the outcome. Is that I'm not saying he didn't have the belief or he choked or anything like that. I mean, Filler also just flat played amazing. But I think you put those two things together, you know that Filler's going to play amazing. And James is going to have to respond both physically on the table and mentally in terms of conviction. And those are both two things hard to match there.
Yeah, well, you looked at Joshua, the momentum that he caught on that second day. I think after the first day, everybody thought, well, okay, James did pretty good that day. It was close. Filler's position on a few racks was a little bit off for him, and he paid a price for that. But the amount of racks that were put back-to-back that first day was, you know, maybe 2, 3, 4 or something. But the second day, a couple of mistakes made by James were overpowered with, you know, 6s, 7s, and 8s or whatever. 10 did he run one time? I mean, when you're making a mistake and you're not getting back to the table for, you know, whatever time it takes for him to run a rack, he plays fast, Filler does, so it doesn't take too long to run a rack for him. But you've gone 3 innings, and all of a sudden your 5-6 game lead is now you're behind by 14 games, 13 or 14 in the match, in a short period of time in the second round. And that had to be just a tremendous blow. You saw in the third, I watched most of it. I did miss a few racks, but on the third day, you saw the mistake that was made by Aranis on the second day, which turned into an 8-pack. You saw him make the same mistake on the same ball in the same hole. Only he made it worse. He missed it by more.
Yeah,
and that was after identifying that he realized it was the same shot on the same ball.
Yeah.
And after that, he did not play the same after he missed that 6-ball again on the third day. He played offishly. He didn't attack the table. He played good when he played, but he certainly was not breaking the ball as well, breaking the racks as well. He wasn't pocketing the balls on the breaks as well. You know, he broke what? He'd run 2 and then dry break. And then that's all she wrote for. Filler didn't have that 8-9, you know, pack in there the third day. He didn't need to, but he would get 3 or 4 then after that error. One many errors by these two players the whole
they really didn't miss a lot of balls.
They did not.
And I want to clarify, Rob, but we've actually got someone on AZ Billiards named At Large as their handle, and they actually keep track of the stats. And so the actual break and run percentage, and I think this is pretty important, Filler broke and ran 40 out of 100 games he won from the break. So he actually ran out 40% of the time from the break. Aranis ran out 23 racks out of his 72 breaks for a 32% break and run. Their highest package There was Filler actually had the, it was a six pack. He had that when it was 59, 53 on day two, and then Rodas hung that six ball you're talking about. He went to 60 games, and then he broke and ran six racks to close out day two. So he had 1 6 pack, 3 3 packs, 7 2 packs, and 11 singles. And then Aranis had 1 4 pack, a 3 pack, a 2 pack, and 14 singles. And so where the biggest discrepancy was, Filler had a 6 pack to Aranis' 4 pack, but the biggest discrepancy was Filler had 3 3 packs and 7 2 packs. Aranis had 1 3 pack and 1 2 pack. And so that's many, many, many extra times that that Filler's punches were just heavier, you know, when he got control of the table. And even on day two, right before that six rack run, he was Filler was kind of leaking away some shots there for a little bit, but Aranis was really winning them one at a time, and he never was able to really put the racks behind it.
He didn't
Filler, and so it's just when they're playing, you know, you can't. And I've seen this, you know, of course, having a chance to have played these guys, I don't put the racks behind my wins the way that they do, and it's like there's just no way you can go win against these guys winning a rack at a time. Because when they win, they can really pack the punches hard. And so
you better be able to do five or six.
Yeah, well, I mean, even in this case, you know, the stats show. I mean, even a lot of twos and threes add up. And but you just can't win and then surrender the table. Win and surrender the table. And it sounds like on day one, it's kind of when James was hitting the hardest. And then as Filler started rallying on day two and stuff, he just couldn't return fire to the same level. And when it's like you're playing a game of tug of war where you're trying to pull the other guy uphill, you're just at a massive disadvantage. So anyway, I just wanted to share those stats. I thought those shed some light.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I definitely agree with both of your guys' points. Before the match started, I kind of thought that this was going to, and day one was kind of a testament of, James was playing really good. Filler was struggling a little bit with his speed. I don't know if that's just kind of pre-match jitters or whether that's just getting used to the table. I mean, he had been there before a couple days before and they had played a bunch of pools, so I can't imagine it was, you know, getting used to the table. I gotta imagine it's probably just some pre-match jitters or something going on there, to where his speed was, he was going long on almost all of his shots. But I think, and I said this in real time, and Demetrius, we actually had a small conversation on the watch party that we had for the podcast. At 58-53, when James hung that six ball, I had posted in there, like, this is way, way, way early on this, but I think that could be the thing that we look back on this match and be like, well, that's the reason why Joshua Filler won. And I called that in real time. And the next thing because if James gets out there, it's 58-54, we're looking at a four-game spot, and Filler couldn't get anything done at that time. Like you said, he was kind of missing balls and overrun in positioning, and he was really struggling in that small little window of time there where he basically gave up a 14-game lead down to a 5-game lead at that time when he hung the ball. So it would have been a 4-game lead. So he had basically bled away 10 games of a 14-game lead. But then he hangs that ball, and then, you know, like we'd already said, Filler runs out the rest of the set from there and runs a six-pack plus the two-game swing of that game. So that game, hanging that six ball, ended up costing him 8 games at the end of day two. And this was I called this before, obviously, this 8-game swing happened, but it just seemed like in that moment Joshua was just struggling to be able to find any sort of run-out ability, and then he's just handed a game, and next thing you know, the break starts coming around when a little bit of confidence is there, and it turns into what I think is pretty much the match. Day three is more of the same, where Joshua Filler, just his break is just too much for James. I mean, James was breaking the balls extremely well, too, a little bit better than I thought that he had the ability to do going into this, and so now I have to reassess James's break. But, at the end of it,
he did better when he changed sides.
Yeah, well, in the beginning, James was making three, four balls a pop, and, you know, whether or not he was coming up with a position was the difference. And that was the huge difference from what I saw between James and Filler, where James, yeah, he was probably, I bet if you, I don't know, maybe this the guy that you were talking about has the stats for this, but the average balls made on the break, I bet James was probably at least a half a ball more per average, more than James, but the success rate of the break for James, I bet, was 20% higher than it was for James, meaning that one ball was just slowly drifting up into the top left corner, and the cue ball was getting planted right in the center of the table. So he'd have, you know, basically a straight in shot on the one ball each time. At worst, he's got a jump shot. So, I mean, that was
a
filler.
I've actually got it right here, and you're absolutely right. On 100% on everything you said, filler on his successful breaks was averaging 1.5 balls per break. On his all breaks, it was 1.2 balls per break. Whereas Aranis was 1.8 balls per break on successful, 1.5 on all breaks. So basically, yeah, 0.3. So the difference between on all, let's just go on all breaks, 1.2 for filler, 1.5 for Aranis. But you're right. I was watching and Aranis was bouncing off the rack, arcing over to the left-hand side rail, hitting above the side and kind of dribbling. The one was going towards the middle of the end rail and bouncing out where he'd sometimes have a shot at the corner. Sometimes he was having to cut the ball thin. Sometimes they get kind of weird. But you're right. Filler was stopping ridiculously consistently in the middle of the table, playing that one up in the top left corner. And boy, was that deadly.
Yeah, and he was making that, not the wing ball, but the ball on the right side to that side pocket. I bet he made that. And I know your buddy, I know the guy doesn't have stats on this, because why would he? But I bet he was making that that ball on the right side to that side pocket probably 80% of the times that he had a successful break, at least 80%, probably more than that. And he was, you know, on a, just in breaks in general, I bet he made it 60% of the time. I mean, that ball was going into that side pocket super consistently.
Yeah, yeah.
How many times did he make four balls on the break?
That we don't know, but I'll tell you. But what to Nate's point, what happens, you know, is he strikes, when you strike the rack, it's a double whammy. It's like not only are you controlling your cue ball perfectly, but then you're getting this consistent reaction. So when you lose your cue ball on the break, not only do you sometimes scratch, or not only do you not always get shape, you lose the cue ball, you lose the one ball. And then you don't get that ball tracking towards the side of the same way. And I'll tell you guys, for those of you that, you know, maybe when you're not a table runner where you're running rotation tables real consistently, you don't think about this, but I've been down this road and I will tell you, I want you to think about the three things that have to happen to have a good break. You have to control, you have to have a ball go in, and then you have to have the cue ball and the one ball stop to where you get a shot. And if you're losing the cue ball and you're losing the one ball, and you're not sure if something's going to go in, then you need to slop in a ball and then have the cue ball and the one ball roll around the table, stop to where you could hit the ball and have a shot at it and be able to get on the two. It can be very, very difficult. So if you're not breaking well, it can feel like it takes a miracle to make a ball and get a shot. But when you strike the rack really, really accurately with a template rack, you can control the cue ball, you can control the one ball, and you can play that ball in the side pocket. You solve all three variables. So instead of a slot machine where it has to come up 7-7-7, oh boy, I finally made something on the break, and look, my cue ball didn't get kissed, and I've got some kind of a shot at the one. This is a miracle. First time it's happened in 7 games. Instead of feeling like it has to be a slot machine to get a shot at the one and keep your inning going, for Josh, it's like a shot like any other shot where you play, you know, when you make the one and you play position on the two, and then you get in shape. You don't act like you got lucky to get shape on the two. You just play for that. Well, Josh plays for that. And it's and I know that, you know, most top players are like, yeah, we all know that. But really, if you're not breaking that way and you play at a run-out level, now, if you're not at a run-out level and you're still learning the game, obviously, you know, learn the game. But if you're running tables and then when you break, you're still breaking like the 90s where you're kicking your leg and letting the stuff fly around the table, it's time to kind of consider what the game is like today.
Yeah, and that kind of goes to the point that I had earlier where I actually expected James Aranis to have, you know, close to half a ball increase, and it turns out it was 0.3. But that is kind of the difference between those breaks is Filler hits it exactly hard as he needs to hit it to get that one ball up into the corner and get that that ball into the side pocket. And if you noticed, and the video is still there, so anybody who has the opportunity, I invite you to go back and look at this. Filler, most of the time, that ball did not fly into the socket, into the side pocket. It drifted into the side pocket. You know, maybe a half a diamond past where the side pocket would have, you know, been if it's not there. Meaning, he's hitting that rack exactly hard enough to get that it was usually the nine ball. I don't know if that was on purpose, but it seemed like he made the nine ball most of the time there. that nine ball would just creep into that side pocket. And he did that, I'm sure, on purpose, because he knew exactly how hard he needed to hit it. And he's so good at controlling that to where you're breaking at 19.8 miles an hour every single time. Just hard enough to get that ball into the side pocket, and just hard enough to get that one ball within a 1.5 by 1.5 diamond square from that top corner pocket. And that is exactly consistency, and that is the reason why he's one of the top breakers in the world, and that is, I think, the reason why he won this match.
I can't argue with that. You know what I mean? He's so then, yeah. I'm sorry, I you couldn't have said it better. It got a little quiet, so I wanted to agree for sure that played a big role. Because Aranis, to be fair, you know, Aranis, I mean, the guy ran out like water. He didn't look intimidated. He did his thing. He played his game, and he played the game that's been winning him tournaments. So shout out for him for getting in the ring and holding up as well as he did, because, gosh, man, it just, against that performance of Fillers, it's actually pretty amazing how well he did and how far he got. So I'll give the man some props.
Oh yeah, for sure. No, he played great. He really just kind of cracked that. I saw the whole match, maybe two shots that were definitely within his ability, easily within his ability that he.
Well, you know what though, Rob,
he just missed. I mean, one straight in shot, table length shot that was critical. You know.
Here's where I disagree is that it's a race to 100. They're going to miss shots. I mean, Filler, we just talked about when it was 59, 53. Filler had been leaking off a number of shots to James.
My point was he didn't miss many.
Okay.
That was my point. No, he didn't miss many. He only missed two that I saw that were very makeable. That was it.
Oh,
I see. In 72 wins, he only missed two shots that were, well, I would say, were easy, but they were at a time in the match where it was maximum pressure. So that was it. He just cracked twice that I saw the whole match. So that's pretty good.
I think one thing that they both have in common is that they both play real loose. And that when you're playing these long matches, and even in tournament matches, I've noticed, you know, these guys, there's too loose and there's too tight. And I think I've seen this many, many times, and I've come to see that all the best players do this. They tend to play too loose and then dial it in and get the right balance, as opposed to starting too tight and trying to loosen up. And I think this is a big change of since pool, since the 80s and 90s, when it used to be, and maybe this is a hangover from straight pool where one shot could cost you the entire game. But it seems like back when Buddy Hall and Mike Siegel and Nick Varner, it seems like they played very careful on every shot where, you know, they, even in the tournament sets, race to 11 or whatever, it seemed like they were always playing like it was a hill on every shot, and they'd play tight. And sometimes they'd be a little jittery in the beginning and be a little tight, and they'd play tight and try to loosen up as they gain confidence and rhythm. Nowadays, players, it's the opposite. These guys start out playing a little bit too loose, where it almost looks reckless at times, and then they settle into this optimal balance where they're really playing loose, but focused and careful at the same time. So I've seen this where, for example, Clint DiCacci used to play really slow, and he was doing well, but then he shifted to where when he started playing like money matches against Alex, he came out of the gate freewheeling and then tightening up, but dialing it in. And I've seen this from, you know, all the top money players. And even they do this in tournaments. They're not just doing this in races to 100. They're doing this in tournament matches where they come out of the gate firing, and then they dial it in a little bit. And
let me
what do you think about that?
Well, I want to ask you a question based off of that. So you were talking about Mike Siegel, Buddy Hall. You know, I'm sure you could probably throw a couple of other players in there too to, you know, really pad the statement. But what the people that you're talking about in the era that you're talking about, you're not talking about 22, 24, 28-year-old players. I mean, at the time, Mike Siegel and Buddy Hall were probably in their 40s, maybe late 30s. Do you think that that's part of? Do you think that that's a conscious decision that's going on by the players, or do you think that that is just a byproduct of their age? And generally speaking, you know, older players tend to be more fearful at the table than somebody like Joshua Filler, who's young and has all the confidence in the world. Do you think that that is more of a byproduct of that, or do you think that's an actual conscious decision that is being made by the players these days?
No, I think you're onto something. I do think that it could be I don't know if it's age or experience or what, because, yeah, you're right, like Jim Rempe or Steve Vizrak, all these guys. And then you think about some of the guys that were fast and loose, and it was a young Earl, a young Johnny, a young C.J. Wiley. They played kind of fast and loose. So I think you're right. And I think that one of the big changes is that the average age of championship pool has been dropping. And so that's probably a testament to just maybe, number one, how much information and training and resources are available online, and the training regimens that are in place in different countries, to where, you know, yeah, you're right. If the finals are being decided between, you know, a number of guys in their late 30s, early 40s, you're going to see a different matchup than when the matches come down to guys that are, you know, 20 to 22 years old, and you got Fedor and Kachi and Gorst you know, I already said that, but you know, I've repeated myself. but anyway, yeah, you get all these young guys, Alvin Ocean and Filler and all, you know, Aradas. You get all these young guys that come in. You're right. They do. I think that might be, but at the same time, it could also be, you know, I think you're right. I think a lot of it's age experience based, but I wonder if it's also a shift in kind of what's effective, which is that today's games, because even Shane, let's look at Shane. He used to play, when he played Corey Duell in 2006, he played pretty, not tight at all. He was definitely a runaway train gear, but he played where every shot was important to him. And I feel that when he really peaked, he started loosening up more and more, to where I actually felt like he made more unforced errors in 2012 than he did in 2007, but that I felt like his overall level of game was higher because he was just flowing. And even though he'd make a few errors that seemed careless or avoidable, he just fell into this flow zone where he just steamrolled through so many tough racks that if he'd been trying to, like, shot by shot, pick his way through every rack, you know, methodically, I don't think he would have been able to put the packages and the runs together he did. And so I felt like Shane actually is a weird example of a guy that gained experience, got a little older, and actually played more flow than he did in 2006 to 2007. So I don't know. It's hard to say, but all I know is that, the age is getting younger, the pace is getting more aggressive, more flow, and I know they're correlated. They could be, you know, related in a few different ways, but that's certainly what I'm seeing.
Well, I'm going to jump in. I'm going to cut the conversation off here, and I'm going to cut the conversation off from here because I think we're going to have a lot of time in the coming weeks to actually talk about some of these things, because we're not going to have anything else to talk about. And this is actually a pretty fascinating thing for me, because I think it gets into a huge broad question of, because if you're playing fast and loose, you're playing with confidence. And if you're playing tight, you're probably questioning a little bit of confidence. And I think that there's a huge, huge, huge discussion that we could have off of this. And I don't want to have that dilute the conversation that we're having right now. But we are going to come back to this in the coming weeks, because I think it's a very good question to talk about. So hopefully you guys are all right with that.
Yeah, I'm good with that for sure.
Yeah, so we can head back to the match. And I guess that's kind of the takeaways of the match. I guess, is there anything else that I know, Rob, that you wanted to mention something about day three? Did you want to say that now?
Yeah, sure. I was watching the behavior, player behavior, as the score widens and the match gets closer to the end, and the pace of play picked up for Filler. He was shooting quickly, but toward the end, he was shooting even faster, and because it was less and less stressful, I'm sure, as he was going. But along with that came some, what from what I saw, was playing so loose that you weren't getting the position you needed. And he actually, once he got over 90, he was making some position mistakes. And I thought, oh boy, every time he made a mistake, and then Aranis would get that rack, and I thought, here you go. You know, now this is your chance, James. Now make this count. Get four or five here. And it would be one or two. And I thought, okay, the end game being ahead factor is working a little bit here. He had an end of one game after like 96 or something where he had the 8, 9, and 10 kind of in a little line down past the spot. They were all three were right there. He shot those three balls in less than 2 seconds. Not 2 seconds apiece. All three. Within less than 2 seconds. So that's a, you know, I saw that kind of thing, and how, you know, you get to the horses getting to the barn kind of thing. And you've been there, Demi, in matches where you're, you know, you get that, this kind of thing 50 years ago is what I saw a lot in straight pool. And to the point about the age thing, old and young, I think the game that was being played, when that game changed, basically nationwide, from straight pool to nine ball, all of a sudden you saw a huge influx of younger players starting to pick up the game and play the game, and younger names showing up. Other than that, yeah, I have all the great players in the country were all well over 40, except with an occasional, you know, young player coming along. So that's what my comment about Joshua was, that, you know, at the end, that experience, what that's like. We've been, and then because we kind of loosen up too much, we start to give our opponent a chance to edge back in the match. That didn't happen in this match, it could have.
It'd be interesting to see if what Filler's thought process is on that, because I don't think I never saw James give up. I saw him get frustrated on day three, and that was when his break wasn't really working very well. And, yeah, you know, that's pretty hard not to do, but I never saw him give up in him. No, I never saw him give up at all. And no. That's kind of my point is I never saw him give up. I saw him get frustrated, but I never saw him give up. So yeah. I'm kind of wondering how much of that was, how much of Filler's attitude was, I guess his loosey goosey kind of mentalities, because everything was going his way on day two and day three. Everything was going his way.
He should have scratched three times on that third day and didn't.
Yeah, I mean, he got not every role, but I mean, he got the majority of roles and the majority of big roles. So I'm wondering how much of his loosey-goosey kind of mentality to the game was just because, you know, everything was going in his favor. He's up, you know, what is it, 17, 18 games at the time. He wasn't going to, in his mind, he wasn't going to lose that match. He's just kind of, well, all right, I guess I got to get myself to the finish line, but I don't really need to be super focused on it anymore.
Right.
I wonder how much of it was that, and how much of it was, you know, just I want to play faster. I think a lot of it was just the match was over. Whether James Aronis believed it was or not. I mean, he couldn't get a roll, and he wasn't potting balls on the break as consistently as Filler was. So again, James never gave up. Even when he was 99-72, I still didn't think he gave up. I mean, I still saw that same kind of fire in the eyes that I see a lot of Filipino players, that it just seems to be bred into them that they are just fierce competitors no matter what. But
did you notice though on game three, on day three, the difference in the pocketing of the balls, where the balls were hitting the inside of the pocket? On day three, James's shots, a lot of them, I'd say at least 40%, were hitting the incoming rail before they were going in the pocket, where Filler's were not. The balls he was shooting were going center in the middle of the hole. It wasn't even touching the rails. And that showed up on day three more so than the other 2 days.
No,
hence the miss on the six ball, you know, hit the rail first. Yeah.
So, Demetrius, do you have anything else to add in or say on this topic?
I think that covers it, man. What a great match.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was fun to watch. It really was. I don't watch a lot of pool, but I did enjoy that match.
So I will take a couple announcements from here. One, so for matches like this that are going to be free and streamed to Facebook, the Cue It Up podcast is going to start doing watch parties. And we did one for day one, day two, and day three this week. And it's basically just a place for all of the listeners of the podcast. They can come in, they can, you know, Demetrius, Rob, and I were all in there for most of the time on day two and day three for sure. So you can interact with us. You can interact with the other listeners to the podcast. I mean, there's no trolls, at least that I've noticed in the podcast community thus far. So, you know, there's those big chat rooms that are like the Roy's Basement one. It's just toxic with all the stupidity that you see going through the comments. It's like it's not even fun to be a part of a discussion like that because everybody's so stupid. So we are going to create the watch parties that are going to be completely filtered out to the
where stupidity is not allowed.
Yeah, right. So we're gonna filter out all the trolls and the idiots, and we're just gonna have a good Facebook discussion between the hosts of the podcast and anybody who wants to be in there. So I know that a lot of people did not see this, and once I mentioned it to them, they were like, super on board with jumping in. You know, Tracy Featherly, I could say she was like that. Mike Hahn was in there. He joined after I told him. Yeah, Jeff Smoller was in there. You know, there was a bunch of people listening to the podcast that were in there, and we were all having a great discussion. I mean, we were talking about the match. We were talking about, you know, anything and everything. I tried to actually do some commentating for a little while. That didn't work out very well because I didn't know how to set it up. But that'll be a project for me in the future to try to figure out how to make that swing so that I could actually do the live commentary on there if the commentary isn't very good. So, you know, I think it was a really good discussion had in the group. So in the future, if there's a match like this, always head over to the Cue It Up podcast page. And assuming you want to, and join in a discussion. Let's build a community between the listeners, not just, you know, a bunch of people that listen to the podcast. Let's actually try to form a community and, you know, kind of form a subgroup of the pool population that listens to the podcast and isn't a troll or a idiot. I think that'd be fun.
I'm a fan of fun.
Yeah, come on over, guys. Let's do it.
I'm a fan of fun.
Yeah, and you can always ask questions to Rob, myself, and Demetrius when you're in there. So it could be fun to pick our brains on the match and anything else that's happening. And where
I was having trouble with a time delay factor.
Yeah, the face
when I got on
I think
there,
it's
that was
you're
weird.
From the sticks, and you don't have internet out there or something. That was weird.
Yeah, I've got internet.
So
from the '60s, but I got it.
I guess at this point we can move on from that. A huge shout out to Roy and Josh and James and Pia and all of the people who, you know, did the commentary, the match, and all that good stuff. And hopefully there's going to be more matches coming up soon with Roy's Basement, but who knows? So we can leave it there and we can move on to what's coming up. So, like I said in the beginning, Chip Compton and Roberto Gomez, that match has been postponed. We don't know until when. But it's certainly not happening this weekend like it was scheduled. So we'll have, I guess, two kind of announcements here. I am going to be playing in a challenge match tonight, and it is going to be a big table 10-ball race to 17 on a diamond big table. So I am going to be streaming that live to Facebook. I might put it on the Facebook page. I probably will put it on the Facebook page. I'm sure people want to watch some pool. So it's going to be super laid back. It's going to be a gamble, but it's going to be a gamble between friends, and it's going to be ish cheap. It's definitely cheap for a race to 17, and we're just going to put it on to basically get some pool content out there before the entire state of Wisconsin goes into lockdown tomorrow. So if you're interested, tonight around 7 Central, we are going to be streaming live, and you can watch myself and Mike Taylor play some 10 ball on the big table. So that could be fun. It's not pros, but, you know, we're going to try and put on the best show that we can put on. Just so everybody knows, I was not able to get the podcast out before I actually played this challenge match. So this is being put in later on. But that match is up on Facebook and it does exist. And there was a couple of hiccups that I learned from using the new camera. So I learned a lot of things for the future, so it'll be better. But there's a couple sections that the match is in. And, you know, that's just a couple rookie mistakes that I made that won't be a problem in the future. But if you're interested in how I play personally, or you just want to watch some pool because you have nothing else to do because we're all locked down, you can head over to the Cue It Up podcast page, and those videos are there. You might have to dig a little bit because they were from, you know, yesterday. Full disclosure, it's the 25th of March today when I'm going to be getting this out, and it's like 11 o'clock at night. So I'm trying to get this out ASAP so, one, I can go to bed, and two, you guys have some content in your feeds. So this is being placed in about a day and a half after we actually recorded the podcast, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to get it out sooner, but the match is there, and there are a couple of other videos there that I did with the camera. So I think those will be fun. You can head over and check those out if you're interested. And I guess back to the podcast. And then, so we figured, you know, the Chip Compton match isn't going to happen, so we don't really have anything to talk about besides that. So we figured maybe we'd do some speculating. And Joshua Filler is still in the States. He's still at Roy's Basement, and he's still trying to find more matchups. So I figured for this we could do Joshua Filler versus ? We'll keep these shorts to keep the podcast moving, but who do we want to see Joshua Filler play against next, and in what game? Rob, would you like to go first?
Who do I want to see? Well, I want to see somebody with this closest Fargo number to him. I'm concerned about these Fargo numbers.
Well, that would be probably Shane. All right, so you're probably thinking Joshua and Shane, and we're gonna discuss that soon. So we won't go.
Well, I don't know. What are their numbers?
Well, Shane is an 826, and Filler's an 824.
Yeah, then I suppose
the top four are Shane, Wu, Filler, and Chang.
Yeah, Joshua Filler's an 823.
They're all rated. You know, I mean, they're all rated 822 to 826. Yep. So I think that, you know, Wu, unfortunately, we haven't seen him been able to get into matches in this format. But it seems like Filler, Chang, and Shane are the three candidates for King of the Hill in this format.
Yeah, well, if that's going to happen, it's got to be Shane. I don't think the others are going to travel if they don't live here.
Yeah. Chang is back in Taipei, so that's not going to happen. So, Demetrius, who would you like to see? And in what format?
Well, you know, I'd like to see all three of these players play each other. I'd like to see Shane play Chang. I'd like to see Shane play Filler, and I'd like to see Filler and Shane. But first, I think if I had to pick one, I think that we'd all love to see Shane Van Boning take on Joshua Filler. While they're both playing good, while they're both feeling good, I would like to see Big Table 10 ball, because that is the game. It's because here's the problem. If Filler plays Shane 9 ball, if Filler wins, everybody's going to be like, well, how come they didn't play 10 ball? But if Filler guns Shane down playing 10 ball, then if he wins, race to 110 ball against Shane, that kind of ends that conversation. You know, it doesn't mean that Shane can't ever win again. It just means that there's no place to hide. If Filler plays him in that format and wins, he really earned it.
Yep,
and I think that it's possible. You know, if anybody has what it takes to do so, nobody can count him out. So it's a pretty exciting match, I think, if they could.
I would like to see, and this is kind of a unique format that I don't think it would ever happen, but I would like to see Justin Bergman play against Joshua Filler without the breaks coming into effect. So maybe push out after the break, or maybe even a neutral breaker, and then somebody just shoots from there. I think that would be really, really fun type of format to watch this match with. And you have to take the breaks out of it, because Filler's just going to eat Justin Bergman alive when it comes to breaking the balls. But I don't know that Joshua Filler has more run-out ability or just more cue power than Justin Bergman. In fact, if there's anybody in the world who might have the same cue power or maybe even a little bit more, it might be Justin Bergman. The only knock on Justin Bergman is he doesn't break the balls, you know, at that level. But he doesn't miss many balls, and he plays ridiculously strong as far as just after the break. So I think that would be a really, really fun matchup to watch. You know, after the breaks, Joshua Filler versus Justin Bergman.
Not only do I agree with that a ton, I mean, there was one other sentiment that I echo that was shared on AZ Billiards, which is it's a bummer that a great game like this, that so much of it comes down to that skill of being able to strike that rack. And you know, I've talked about it before. It's very disheartening for players that have put in a lifetime of work that because they don't crack the egg as quite as well as somebody else does, you know, like Bergman. It's just kind of a shame. And also the formats and tournaments, you know, we were talking about how, you know, I'd love to see a game, you know, that's either takes out the break a little bit more, you know, either full rack rotation or mandatory push out after the break or, you know, there's a lot of different things you can do, even using a triangle rack where the balls don't rack as well playing 10 ball, just different things you can do to kind of just make a little bit more clusters, a little bit more gameplay, make it so that there's more games where both players get to the table and they're grappling and coming with shots as opposed to just kind of stringing out open racks, which is amazing. But so I'd love to see that. And I'd also love to see a format where, you know, I was talking about this too, where like in chess, they have a candidates tournament where they have a reigning world champion that gets to play the following year's world championship. And then they have a candidates tournament to see who's going to challenge the world champion. And so whoever wins the candidates tournament plays the world champion in a heads up match that's extended out over several weeks and a lot of games. And it's very, very fun. And if they had a match like that where the world champion was automatically going to defend their title, we had a long format tournament to see who could play, you know, a series of, you know, whoever gets seven races to 21 first over the course of 3 weeks. And the game was a little bit less break heavy. those would be, I mean, of course, not for every tournament, not for every game, but at least, you know, for the world championship, I would love to see longer heads up formats for the world title. And I'd also like to see a game that's not as break heavy. So those are my things. So when you talk about Bergman and having a neutral breaker, you know, it just, it gave me a little pang because boy, I'd really love to see the game as much as I love seeing big street, you know, big packages and stuff. I really like more after the break play and guys like Justin Bergman would have an opportunity to really rise to the top.
Yep. I agree.
I'm kind of more old school about it. I think the break's a break. If you're good at it, yeah, more power to you. If you're not as good at it, practice.
Yep.
Get better at it.
Yep, I agree.
You know, so I don't like all this other stuff about those. To me, are that does not appeal to me. It's like gimmicky kind of thing. And yeah, the racks should be you'd learn something by the way they handle the cue ball. Then after that, but.
But Rob, back in the 80s and 90s, when people were breaking the balls, they had slow cloth with wooden racks, and the balls were not all perfect, and the racks, they were slugging into racks. And if you watch AccuStat matches from the 80s and 90s, they're also playing ball in the kitchen and ball spot up on the scratches. And what was happening is there was a lot of clusters. They'd break the balls open, and they'd come up dry. Or they'd break the balls, and there'd be three or four balls tied up in the rack area because they couldn't separate them because they were no slugging it.
Yeah.
And so the there was so much... There was so much play after the break that you know, nowadays with the template racks and the diamond tables,
right.
You don't see. I mean, you hardly see clusters. You don't hardly see dry breaks. I mean, it's just so it's not. So to say, I like it old school.
I agree with
Just hey, learn the skills in the old school. If you learn the skills, you were competitive. Now, if you learn the skills, you can solve the game. And anyway, that's all I wanted to say about that.
Sure.
Yeah. So why don't we move on to the end of the podcast then? We are going to talk about Filler versus Shane right now, and we will talk it in the exact same format that Aranis and Shane just played. What do we think is going to happen, and who's going to win?
Wow.
Who's first?
You want to go first, Robbie?
I think it's out there. I think that there's only one outcome, is that the table itself will explode. I don't think it'll be able to handle the stress between these two.
That's funny.
Rob.
Well, it's certainly going to be close. I don't think we're going to see what we saw with Aranis. It's going to be within, I think it's going to be within 10. And I'd call a winner. If Filler plays the way he did and breaks the way he does, there's no answer for that. There just isn't. Any answer. If you're averaging, what did he average for the whole tournament? You know, for 2.6 every time he got up there to shoot racks or whatever it was, his overall tournament average. Yeah, that's tough. That's tough action. I don't think Shane will beat that.
All right. Dimitris.
Filler's on the top of his game.
I agree. Dimitris, you want to go next?
Yeah. This one's a really, really tough one. And so when it comes to confidently, like, oh, this one's not a lock. Anybody that thinks that this is a lock on either side, you know, either they know something I don't, or they see it a little differently. I feel like this one, these guys both have the game to get there. They both have the heart to get there, and it's really, really tough to want to empty out on one side of this match or the other. And to be fair, that's probably why it won't happen. But if they were to play, I've been waffling on my mind here for the last 4 or 5 days. Here's what I've come up with. I'm going to take Shane. And I'll tell you, this is ridiculous, but I'll tell you why. So Shane's Fargo rate's at 826. Filler's is an 823. So for all practical purposes, that's the same. What I would say, though, is that Shane, to me, the last few years, has looked I wouldn't go so far as to say burned out or disengaged, but not as hungry and focused and filled with fire as Filler's been. And so normally you would think, well, I would rather bet on the guy who's hungrier and full of fire. The problem is that Shane has a higher Fargo rate, or the same, let's just call it the same Fargo rate, while being fishing half the time and kind of like, yeah, you know, a little irritable. And so that's baked into Shane's performance. So Shane's performance has been the same with even with being a little frustrated or disengaged or burned out. So what happens if you get him into a race to 100 in his home format where he knows the format, he's run this thing. That's another thing, his experience. He's done it so many times. He knows that format. He knows the pace of play. He knows the milestones. And then all of a sudden you lock the door in that cage. And what happens if Shane's heart gets beating? And he's only 36 or whatever. You know, what happens if he starts remembering what it means to fight? What happens if all of a sudden his adrenaline starts getting there and he starts getting hungry? If his Fargo rate's 826 when he's disengaged, then what happens when Shane gets, once you lock that door on him and corner that tiger at the back of the cage? I mean, I would be afraid of Shane. I feel like Shane in that format would wake up a little bit and get hungry again, and that his hungry game might actually even be a level above. That might be wrong, but that's how I look at it. So people that think that Filler's hungrier and wants it more and is on fire right now, I'd say, yes, that's true. And that's baked into the fact that they're hanging together. So what happens when Shane wakes up a little bit and gets really hungry? I'm not saying that it's a one-sided thing, but I think that's what I would tip towards Shane.
There's a couple of things that I wouldn't mind addressing, and they have nothing to do with the match. You said, I don't think that this match will happen. And I would like to basically just take a little bit of a discussion on that, because I think it's a valuable discussion to have. I agree with you. I don't think that this will ever happen. And the reason I don't think it'll ever happen is because there's just no incentive. Like, if you're going to have a match like this happen, you got to have both parties wanting it, right? So Roy asked Shane when he was having the match with Aranis, basically, hey, do you want next up? And Shane says, no, I'm out fishing and I'm happy being here. That's probably true, and that might have nothing to do with it. I'm certainly not accusing Shane of being scared or anything and rather fish. Like, I think that that's a genuine response. Shane loves ice fishing. We all know this. But it got me thinking, why would Shane want to take this match? Shane's legacy is completely sealed. The only thing that's going to do anything for Shane's legacy is maybe another U.S. Open title. Yeah, a World Pool Masters, it would be a tiny little thing, but it'd be like a seventh paragraph thing for his career. You know, the World Pool or the World Cup of Pool, if he won it with Sky, that'd be like a seventh paragraph thing on his Wikipedia page. It would be almost nothing. There's nothing that could make his legacy any better than what it is right now, besides probably a U.S. Open title. So then what is the incentive for Shane to want to take this match? Well, then if it's not going to be your legacy, it's going to be money. Shane is very comfortable financially. I mean, he's made a lot of really solid investments, a lot of really smart investments. He doesn't need another $5,000. Would he like another $5,000? Sure, of course, but you're not going to get this match for $5,000. It's, you know, this is probably going to have to be a minimum $50,000 bet. So does Shane need $50,000? Well, does he need the risk of $50,000? Probably not. In the grand scheme of things, I think from what I know of Shane's finances, and I don't want to count another man's money, so don't take this as disrespect if you hear this, Shane. I think Shane is well enough financially off that $50,000 is not going to make or break him like many other pool players it actually will. So there's no financial reasoning for him to take it. There's no legacy reason for him to take it. So why should he take it? Well, the only thing that I could come up with is that he just hates filler so much and he has such a negative taste in his mouth that, you know, he just hates filler so much that he would want to take the match just to rub it in his, what he thinks is his snotty little nose. Is that worth, because this actually could do a negative thing to his career in a sense that, well, I guess he's been overtaken. He has this Captain America kind of mentality where nobody can touch him. He's Captain America. He's, you know, he's on top of the world and everybody knows it, right? If he loses this match to Joshua Filler, he no longer has that mystique around him. So that is actually a huge deterrent from why Shane would want to take this. Sponsorships, different money can be brought into Captain America just for the sake of it being Captain America. If he loses that mystique, that actually could be a detriment to his career going forward. So there's just no incentive for Shane to want to take this match. It's a lose-lose basically from the start.
And to combine what you're saying with what I'm saying, if he's not hungry and inspired, if he doesn't look at this match and say, you know, everybody assumes that he's looking at it like, you know, he wants to prove that he can beat Filler. He wants to prove he's still the best. But what if he's not? If he's just kind of like, you know, there's just been a never ending row of young guys that want to come on and you know, let them have their day. I don't care. I'm going to play my tournaments. I'll get mine. We can all go our own separate ways. I've got nothing to prove anymore. And I know that even, you know, for me, I've been in a spot where when there's, you know, guys in my area that are up and coming and looking to prove that they can beat all the top players around me, or they can beat me, I don't feel this competitive fire. Like, I need to beat all these young guys to show them something. I'm just kind of like, yeah. And so if I'm at a spot where I feel like they're hungrier and more motivated, then why would I want to play a match where I'm giving up a motivation edge? If I'm playing somebody where I know that they're, you know, dreaming about beating me and just, you know, practicing up and super hungry, and I'm just kind of like, you know, doing my line drills and doing my own thing. It's like, I don't know. I don't like to get in. That's the same reason that, you know, I don't want to play a match where I'm playing a guy for, you know, $20, where to me, I'm just kind of like keeping score. And for them, it's life and death. It's like, I'd rather just practice then, because I don't want to spot somebody at 50% motivation edge because they're all hungry and wide eyed. And I'm just playing it like it's practice. And so for Shane, you know, if Shane does get in the ring, I think he'll be fired up and ready to play, and that I think he'll have a good chance. But if he doesn't get in the ring, it's because he's not going to get in the ring if he's not really fired up to do it.
Yeah. Going back to what I was saying, my evidence for the reason that I think the way that I do, the only motivation that Shane would ever have for this match was to basically rub in Shane's viewpoint, probably his snotty little nose and not being a better player than him. And I think that that is so when this match really took off steam was right after the Moscone Cup. And I think that that motivation for Shane at the time was there. He had just gotten kind of beaten down 10-1 or was it 10-0 in the Moscone Cup in singles matches against Filler? Can either of you remember?
Yeah, I'm not
that?
Sure, but it was pretty bad.
Yeah, it was either 10-0 or it was 10-1 that Filler beat him in two separate matches. And, you know, Shane probably was a little peeved that, you know, the entire world is on fire with, oh my God, is Shane lost it? Is Filler now the best? And I'm sure there was a lot of internal motivation for Shane at the time. You know, I think that, again, even after the Moscone Cup, he doesn't need the money. You know, it's not make or break for his life. He's going to be comfortable no matter what. He doesn't need it for his legacy, maybe his like immediate legacy and his immediate image, but that's not his, you know, his long-term legacy. So I think that there was enough motivation right after the Moscone Cup of trying to rub his little nose in it, figuratively speaking, that he wanted to have the match happen. And we all know that since then, you know, Roy came onto the podcast and said that, you know, there was a match that was supposed to be happening at the end of April between the two, and that all of those discussions completely fell apart. And I think a lot of it is because Shane just doesn't, he's back to not caring anymore. He doesn't need this in the way that he needed it right afterwards. So I think, I think that's exactly what's going on, and I might be wrong, but I think that's, after thinking about it, I think that's what's going on with the situation.
Well, let's ask this though. So we started this with a speculation, with a disclosure that this probably wouldn't happen. What would happen if Shane did say, you know what, forget it, I changed my mind, let's do this. Who would you like in our speculative match?
Yeah, so when Roy was talking about it, it was supposed to be Moscone Cup style nine ball. So the same rules as the Moscone Cup. I think Filler wins that. I really do think Filler wins that. Coming to 10 ball, I hate saying this because there's really no actual content that it offers, really, besides, you know, if I say, oh, I think it's going to get close and I think it's going to be 95-95 and, you know, somebody's going to win. That doesn't really offer a bunch of content to actually as analysis towards the match. But I mean, I do think it's probably going to be something like that. I mean, Shane still breaks the balls better, 10 ball, than Filler, but Filler shoots the ball straighter than Shane. So where does the divide come into it? If Filler breaks like he does on day two, I think Shane gets steamrolled because Shane doesn't have that gear anymore that is able to, he can't outshoot Filler, I don't think. But he can outbreak him. But if Filler's breaking on that level, you can't outbreak that. I mean, there's no way to break the balls better than he did on day two, pretty much.
Well, I'll tell you, I've seen some matchups, even when Shane played Chang and fell out to a 15-0 lead a year ago on that race to 50. Even when Shane was really, really far behind, when he came back, he closed the gap a little bit and made a pretty good rally, and Chang had to play really, really good to maintain that lead and win. Shane put a lot of threes and fours and twos together. And so when we say that he can't match Filler's firepower, I agree that Filler shoots straighter at this point. But in terms of break and run percentage, you know, Shane is actually still a pip higher, and he can just seem to put a lot of twos, threes, and fours together. And so it doesn't matter how he does it, if he's doing it with, you know, running around the table and firing elevated shots, or if he just does it by just running the table over with a combination of great shooting, great position play, great breaking. He can still lay it down. And so I think but I agree. I think in the end, well, that doesn't mean he's going to win. I think that just means it's going to be very, very tough for both of them.
You mind if I let me clarify really quickly, because I think what you said is it's important. After what you just said, it's important to have myself clarify. Shane breaks the balls better than Filler, and Filler shoots the ball straighter than Shane. But in the last week, I have seen Filler break the balls as good as Shane can break the balls. It's been a long time since I've seen Shane shoot the balls as straight as what Filler's shooting the balls right now. So I know that Filler can do it because I just saw it. I haven't seen Shane shoot the balls as straight as Filler. Now, is that gear in there? Of course it's in there. It's in there. I mean, we're talking about maybe the greatest player who ever touched a pool table. Of course it's in there somewhere. I just haven't seen it for a while. I know that Filler can find it. I just don't know that Shane can find it as easily.
Yeah, so I'll add one last thing, which is that, again, I think that if he gets in the ring, it'll be because he's ready to bring it. And I think that one thing that I learned from, I won't say who I learned this from because I don't want to give up his secrets, but I want a very, very shrewd gambler. This guy probably gives me the 7-8 when it comes to matching up pool matches. He told me there was a match years ago with Shane and Dennis. Not the most recent Shane and Dennis match to 120, but they played a race to 100. I don't know if it was 6 years ago. It might have been 6 or 7 years ago. I don't remember.
I think this is when Shane Van Boning ended up giving Dennis a ride back to California in his car. It's probably
that's right. So at the time, everybody was like, oh, you know, a little bit thinking, you know, if Shane could win or not, because Shane was playing better 10 ball, but then Dennis had been working on his break and Dennis had been breaking a lot better. And people were like, well, does he still have enough of a break edge to make up for how good Dennis is shooting? And I talked to this individual about the matchup, and I'd been betting on Shane against Dallas. I'd been betting on Shane against whoever, and I've been winning and winning and winning. And I was hesitant to bet on Shane against Dennis because there was so much talk about how he'd gotten better on his break and da 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 da. And this guy told me, he said, look, every single time somebody plays the reigning champ, there's always talk about how this next person is the one that's going to upset them, how this next person is the one that's going to take the crown. Every time somebody plays the reigning champ, there's always talk about how good this contender is and how they have all the tools to win. He's like, but here's the thing. Shane has won every time. And so you got to bet on the guy that's won every time. He says, here's why. Because you bet on him and bet on him and bet on him. Maybe over the course of 5, 10, 15 years, you win every bet. And then you just accept. You just accept that at some point he'll lose the title, and at some point one of these guys will be right with their contender, and at some point one of these upcoming champions will show that they can take the title. And when that happens, you pay off one bet at the end. But you've won how many bets along the way? And I listened to him, and I'm like, yep, that makes perfect sense. So I bet on Shane. Once again, Dennis broke okay until Shane started running packages on him. And then that whole break that had gotten so much better didn't look so tough, and it started going sideways, and Dennis started going sideways, and Shane won again. And then I bet on him against Shaw, and then I bet on him against everybody, and I bet on him against everybody again, and I've won and won and won and won and won. So at this point, I've decided I'm going to go down with the ship. I will continue every time Shane plays a race to 100, I will continue to empty on Shane. And you know what? Someday, he'll lose, and then I'll pay off one bet at the end. But I'll be up 20 or 30 bets along the way.
Yep. Rob, anything to add?
That's a great gambling philosophy there. Bet on the New England Patriots every single year.
That's exactly what was going through my head when he was saying that, too.
Bet on Jack Nicklaus every single year. Yeah. No, that's a perfect gambling philosophy. And lose one on the end.
Yeah, I like that.
Well, as far as the match goes, I just like to see it happen. If it comes together, that's great. I think this would be one match that I certainly would be interested in maybe watching the whole thing start to finish.
Yep, this would take the pool world by storm if it happened.
Man, I don't know. It sounds impossible that it would happen, but I'll tell you what, enough people want to see it. You just never know. You just never know. Maybe
6,000, right? 6,500 tuned in at one time. I think I saw the number on there.
I saw as high as 8,000. I could be wrong, but I think I saw 8,000. Yeah.
So that's, I mean, and of course, not everybody gave $5, but I mean, if they did, there's a nice little addition to the.
Yeah, well, it just seems like
enhance the pot. I know that money isn't probably going to be the factor, but whatever the factor is, the fan base in the country certainly would be appreciative of this one.
Yeah, I think Roy did pretty well with that. He did the drawing afterwards, and you know, there was numbers that I saw up to like 2,800. So each of those 2,800 is $5. So
sure.
And don't get me wrong, because I mean I gave $20 to the stream, and I would have given $20 knowing that he's gonna, you know, if he would have made $100 million on that. And I knew that going in. I still would give him $20. Like, it has nothing to do with
it. It was a nice stream.
Oh, it was a phenomenal stream. And he did the best.
It really was good.
Yeah, he did the best that he could do, given the resources that he had. I mean, his commentator booth was right next to the pool room. You know, he put on a professional quality event, having very little resources to be able to do so. I mean, Roy's Basement comes through again to give us... Again, just a phenomenal, phenomenal, phenomenal event to watch. You know, Matchroom and Roy's Basement, if it, you know, the pool community likes to, you know, really shoot themselves in the foot. But between those two promoters, they are dragging the rest of the pool world, kicking and screaming, to a better future in pool.
Yeah, I agree with that, Nate. It's a mouthful.
Yeah.
But it is true.
Yeah, and absolutely. If you watched that match, absolutely support it next time if you're able to. I mean, this is a really tough time, but you know, Roy says even if he takes a loss, he's still going to keep doing this for the love of the game. And you know, obviously, if he's still taking losses, that's going to suck. And how much McDonald's they seem to eat? They probably did take a loss. They probably spent all the streaming money on McDonald's, from what it sounded like. But support Roy in any way that you can. I mean, even if you don't have the money and you want to volunteer to, you know, reach out to him and say, hey, what can I do to help your streams better? You know, where do you want me to share this? Or, you know, maybe there's some work that you can do that he could, you know, that you could help out with it. Let's help out the people that are dragging us to a better pool world for sure. So I guess, I never gave my prediction actually. So I think Filler would win that match though. I mean, and a lot of it is for the reasons that I already said. I think I've seen Filler break at Shane's level, and I've seen Filler shoot at a higher level than Shane at this point. And I haven't seen Shane for a while shoot at that level. So I just have to assume. I mean, I know even given that the spiel that you gave as far as how you bet pool to Demetrius, which I absolutely agree with, I think this might be that one time, and I would be willing to put some money behind it that it's Filler's time. I think he's earned it in the pool community, and I think he has enough of a resume now to take on the champ.
Well, you could definitely be right. Like I said, I'd probably have to just follow my plan to the end. But I definitely would be, if he lost, it would not be out of the. I would not be surprised or horrified or disappointed. But it would be fun. So
I agree. So we can leave that discussion there. And we can go on to our tip segment. So I will start it off. And my tip is going to be head over to the YouTube page for the podcast and watch the video that I did on how to play better 8-ball patterns. I'm not the smartest guy that ever touched the pool scene in the world, but I think that at my level, I think I'm a little bit ahead of my level as far as being able to pick out patterns and play the right ones. And on top of that, you know, certainly the correct things to look out for to avoid as far as trouble. So I think that the video that I put together is a pretty good one, and I'm going to be adding a lot more of them in the future if and only if the listeners want me to. So usually when I say stuff like this, maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, it's getting better, but very few people reach out. If you've watched that video and you thought you got something out of it and you'd like to see more of it in the future, please, please, please reach out and let me know, because I'm not going to do them if nobody's watching them or nobody's getting anything out of them. But I will absolutely make more of them if they're valued and people are enjoying them. So if you liked it, well, first off, go over and watch it if you want, if you're interested. And if you enjoyed it and you would like to see more content like that, and not just the patterns, but other things that I, you know, my viewpoints on a lot of different things, in a in a nice, easy to digest way, let me know, basically. So, yep, that's my tip.
Me next? Me no tip have, okay, in this time, trying times that we're in, I would suggest learning some type of kicking system, diamond system. There's a bunch of them out there, some real simple, some a little more complicated. The one I'm going to recommend to everybody is called the Tuzul system. It's this fellow is from Turkey, I believe. It's T-U-Z-U-L, and it is basically short rail, long rail, short rail. So you're standing at a short rail. You want the ball to come back to you in a certain spot. There's a certain spot you can hit on the other short rail to get it to come back there. And the explanation for this was tricky when I learned it a couple years ago, because it was in a foreign language, and you could see the numbers that they were using, but you couldn't read what the numbers meant. You had to kind of guess at it unless you knew how to read Turkish. But that's changed a little bit now. I've noticed recently that they've made this a little more user friendly. There are a lot of places on the internet you can find this. But T-U-Z-U-L, this is really a nice system for breaking balls up at the other end of the table, for kicking, for trying to get hits on the right or left side of the ball, not just getting a hit, but getting a hit on the side of the ball that gives you another save. And it works. And as long as you know the value of your table, and that's explained, if you want it explained more, I can do that. Just let me know, and I can do it on the air here and explain how a table is given a value number to start with. That's my tip.
And that's actually something I'm going to do, is I'm going to learn a kicking system because I kick so terrible. So that's going to be one of the things that I do during this hiatus. But so we can leave that there, and we can move on to Demetrius's Coaching Corner.
Welcome to another Coach's Corner. Demetrius Gelatis here with MN Pool Bootcamp. Learn more about my pool, one-on-one pool training experience. 3 days, come from anywhere in the country, work with me, leave a different level player. www.mnpoolbootcamp.com. This week, I want to talk a little bit about the importance of focus, the sacrifice of focus, and how that can be a pivotal growth point for a lot of players. I see this again and again, because what happens is, there's different, not everybody plays pool for the same reasons, and sometimes those reasons change. And so I think a lot of players, play recreationally. They get together, they learn the game, they play with pals in their basement or at a pub. And they're kind of joking around and banging balls around and drinking a few beers and rooting for sports on TV. And they, it's a social event, and pool is definitely part of the focus, but it's not necessarily the entire focus. Then you've got, on the other end of the spectrum, you've got real serious players, tournament players, whether it's, professional players or whether it's, regional tournaments. You've got people that are very, very serious pool players, and they play pool differently. They're very focused on the game, and they're devoting all of their attention to what they're doing. And so it's a tricky thing, because what happens a lot of the time is players start recreationally, and then they fall in love with the game, and they start wanting to get better. And as they start getting better, they have to kind of decide, do they want to make the sacrifice of turning more and more attention to the game? And when, when does it make sense to make that sacrifice? And so I see a lot of people that don't necessarily understand how much of an impact it makes on their game, a negative impact it makes on their game when they're not fully focused. And so I see people that are kind of in the middle, where they're not playing recreational anymore. Maybe they're playing tournaments, and maybe they're playing league matches that matter to them, and they're playing sparring sessions with their buddy where they really want to win. But they still got a lot of hangover habits from when they were recreational players. They're still drinking beers, and they're still surfing their cell phone, and they're still joking around in between shots about what they were trying to do or what almost happened. And so those are the players that kind of, I think, need to hear this, is that not to say that there's a right answer of what they should do, but they need to understand what they're doing and kind of make informed decisions. And for a long time, guys, I didn't give lessons, because you know, nobody wanted to hear it. I tell people, you don't want to take a lesson from me because you're going to come and you're going to give me some money. And I'm going to tell you, turn off your phone, put the nachos down, put the beer down, quit talking to him, shut your mouth and play pool. And nobody wants to hear that. And, you know, come again next week, same time. You know, it's like nobody wants to hear that. And so I just feel like if you're a recreational player and you just enjoy splashing balls around and having fun, then do that. We need recreational players. There's nothing wrong with that. And if it's a social thing for you, then I don't want to take that away. But for people that are serious, for people that are watching top pros play, for people that are buying instructional material and watching YouTube videos and doing drills and investing in equipment and taking lessons and are really passionate about getting to the next level, this is something you might want to consider. So just to make it really, really, really tangible, I've put together Nine Ball, the dice game. It's a little thought experiment for y'all. So here's the way Nine Ball, the dice game works. Suppose that we're going to play a game, and here's the rules. There's 5 6-sided dice. We're going to take turns rolling the 5 6-sided dice, and we're going to play, and the way that you score points, you add up the number of points that you rolled. So if I roll 5 threes, I score 15 points. If you roll 5 fours, you score 20 points. And we're going to take turns rolling and adding up our points until we get to some number like 500. Well, at this point, it sounds like a pretty boring game because it's just, what did you roll? It's all luck. But now I'm going to add the strategy element to Nine Ball the Dice game. And that is, before each roll, you get to declare an action off of an action list. And depending on the action you declare, there is a modifier to your roll. So, for example, there is an action that you can declare. You can declare that before your roll, you would like to eat nachos. And if you declare that you would like to eat nachos, there's a -4 penalty to your next roll. Or you could declare that you want to surf your cell phone. And if you want to be on your cell phone, that's a -5 penalty to your next roll. You can also declare that, you know what you want to do is you want to explain why you just missed your last shot and how you would have had position if you'd wobbled that ball in. Well, -3 penalty. You can watch TV, watch the sports game going on. That's -2. Drink a beer. You know what? If you want to drink a beer between shots, that's actually only -1. Some people play pretty good when they drink a beer.
Can I? I'm going +1 on that. I like beer. Continue on.
Or for your last action, you can declare that you'd like to sit down and wait for your next shot. And there is no penalty for doing that. And so if we were playing a game of Nine Ball the Dice game and we were, you know, playing where we both wanted to win, it's pretty obvious. What action would you declare off that list before every throw? Well, you would declare that you're obviously just going to wait for your next turn because that's the only thing you can do that doesn't have a negative impact on your game. And I think people don't really think about it that tangibly. I don't know. My brain works a little different. To me, it seems really, really clear because I look at Efren and I look at Josh Filler and I look at Aranis and I look at Shane and I look at all these guys, Chang, and I've never seen in the finals of a world championship, I've never seen them surfing a cell phone, eating nachos, drinking beers, joking around. And so whenever I see people doing these things, I'm like, do they think that they're so much better than Shane and Filler that they can get away with this? Or do they not realize the impact it's having? Or do they, and they're just not willing to make that sacrifice? And here's what I'd say. If you understand the impact that it's having on your game and you recognize that, hey, I'm not better than Shane and Filler, and that if I do these things, it will impact my performance and I will not play as well. I will play far, far below my potential, but I'm willing to pay that price in terms of gameplay to just keep this social and recreational. If you go into that with your eyes open and that's what you want to do, again, we need recreational players. That's the majority of who plays pool. God bless you. We love you. But don't come ask me for lessons. But if you're a serious player and you've been doing drills and buying equipment and you're like, hey, I enjoy this game differently, instead of enjoying the social aspects and the humorous aspects, I'm enjoying the pursuit of excellent pool, and that's really meaningful and satisfying, rewarding. And so I find my joy from this game in a different way, and playing at a high level means something to me, then you might want to consider making a sacrifice of that short-term distraction to really pursue pool excellence, because that level of focus is required to play great pool. And what you lose on that kind of superficial stuff, you can gain with a higher level of pool. And so at least understand That's the cost of playing better pool. It's up to you if you want to pay that cost, but at least be clear in your mind of what it takes to get to the next level. And then you can make an informed decision so that you're not one of these people that's caught in the middle where you want to play better, but you don't realize what you're doing to yourself and why you don't get there. So those are my thoughts. I would encourage any feedback and comments. Let me know if you have questions. If you want to come work with somebody that can help get you that way. Again, Demetrius here, MN Pool Bootcamp. Thanks so much.
That was a good one. That is some good stuff right there. And lots of things to work on if you are a listener at home during this hiatus. So we can wrap up the podcast there. Rob, Demetrius, thanks again for joining.
All right, catch you next week.
Nate, thanks a lot. As always, it was a lot of fun, very informative. I actually learned how to gamble now. You know, I never knew how before. Bet on the winner. Dang.
Yeah, I like it. You're remarkably bad at it. You are remarkably bad at picking the winner. I think you're like 0-6 for the last like several.
Oh yeah. No, I purposely do that. Yeah.
Yeah, so if you want to make money, just bet against whatever Rob says.
Well, I take the long shot. I go to the track. I always take the long shot. 100-1. That's the guy I want.
Smart.
The guy's never gonna win.
And so thanks again for listening, and till next week. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. If you like what you've heard and you listen through iTunes, please subscribe and leave a rating. It helps others find the podcast. As always, thank you to our sponsors, Jacoby Custom Cues, Cody's Cue Therapy, Jeff Glaz's CBD for Life Global, the Wisconsin Billiards Hall of Fame, The Rocks Sports Bar and Grill, the IQ Practice Cue Ball, and the Wisconsin Pool Player Society. If you like what you hear, consider supporting the people who support the podcast. I would also like to take this time to thank Matt Kitzman, Robert Miller, Natasha, Kurt Elliott, Scott Doolian, Corey Smith, William Sutherland, and Mike Teasy for their help to market the podcast to a larger audience. Lastly, I would like to thank my cousin Andrew Mindham for his band Hey Captain Knight's music as segment and filler music to the podcast. If you like what you hear, you can find all of his music at heycaptainknight.bandcamp.com. And Knight is KNIGHT.